Hello, and welcome to the Television Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be spotlighting a television show or season that we think you'll find interesting. In this episode, I'm joined by my sister, and we're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion on the Birds of Prey TV show. It lasted one season in 2002, just about a month or two into 2003. It was only 13 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a show that was after Smallville had started, but early in Smallville's run. And I think most importantly, it was back in 2002, really before superheroes entered kind of mainstream media.
Yeah.
I would say that was really 2008 and after with the Marvel movies. And this was the closest we got to a primetime Batman series since the Adam West one.
Mm-hmm.
And really after this, it would take until the Batwoman series as part of the Arrowverse. And this series is set in New Gotham because apparently the original Gotham City, I think they said, what, earthquakes or something like that, major disaster, which kind of goes back to one of the many disaster-ish event sagas they've done in Gotham City in the comics. I mean, they've had some times where they'd wall the thing off for No Man's Land, which here was the name of a bar. They had another one, I want to say it was called Cataclysm, where earthquakes shook the thing to its core or whatever. But here, in this reality, they effectively paved it over and rebuilt.
Yeah.
Which, in and of itself, that's a story.
Yes. Yeah.
And the lead characters, one of them is the Barbara Gordon Oracle post the events of The Killing Joke. And not just thematically, since she's in a wheelchair, but we see the backstory flashback of the Joker shooting her.
Mm-hmm.
And I point that out because for a while in comics, The Killing Joke was seen as outside of continuity.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, it was one of those, is it part of, is it not?
Mm-hmm.
And really, there was nothing else in the comics up until Oracle showed up in the Suicide Squad of all places and was later revealed to be, that's Barbara Gordon.
Mm-hmm.
She's in the wheelchair. She's now the computer expert. That's what set that whole thing going.
Mm-hmm.
And until Batman cameoed in that title and the two of them kind of had a moment, it wasn't even clear initially that's who it was. I mean, there were theories, whatever, but prior to that, did The Killing Joke happen in the mainstream universe? Did it not? Was up in the air. Then you've got Huntress here, Helena Kyle, which is the daughter of Batman and Catwoman. That's straight out of the Earth 2 continuity. So, again, kind of mixing and matching stuff. And then rounding out the trio is Dinah Lance, who in this reality is the daughter of Black Canary, has initially precognitive abilities. That kind of goes away. She has telekinetic abilities that come in.
She seems to have, like, touch telepathy at one point.
They say the touch telepathy, but that was kind of mixed with the precog, so it was a little unclear. It was basically vague mental powers that were convenient for the episode, is how
yes,
I took it.
That's a fair description.
And that character was played by Rachel Skarsten, who has probably spent more time in Gotham City this century than anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Because she was one of the few people in all three seasons of Batwoman. So I found that kind of interesting. Plus, for a while, she was playing two characters there.
Yes.
Not long, but a while. So this is a series that was very much ahead of its time. It was interesting while rewatching it, because again, 2002, we're watching it late 2025, and there were a lot of people I recognized, a few I knew were in there. I mean, Shamar Moore.
Yeah.
He was one of the other three people in the opening credits beyond the lead trio. You had Detective Jesse Reese, which was Shamar Moore. You had Alfred Pennyworth, who was in many of the episodes. He was in the opening credits. And then Mia Sara played Harley Quinn, who was mm-hmm. the big bad for the series. And she was in many of the episodes, but not all of them. But really, other than the main three, Shamar Moore, who would later go on to do Criminal Minds, be the lead on SWAT.
Mm-hmm.
There's a spinoff of SWAT he's going to be the lead on.
Mm-hmm.
So he's done quite a bit since.
And he came from, I don't even know how many episodes of Young and the Restless.
Yeah.
And this was his foray into nighttime television.
And it's funny because his character of the detective, the cop, one of the honest cops in the Gotham City PD, one of the few apparently, there were so many scenes where it's like that may as well be his character of Hondo in SWAT.
Yes.
Just the upstanding good guy cop kind of. There are certain lines of dialogue that would fit half a zillion police cops. And he did a great job here. It was clear it was earlier in his career. I think he has just gotten better over time, does a great job in SWAT. It was fun seeing him here. Oracle was played by Dina Meyer from Starship Troopers, among other things. She, I thought, did a very good job as Barbara Gordon.
Her wheelchair drove me nuts.
The wheelchair was as non-standard of a wheelchair as you can get. If you think Professor X's is custom, it's nothing on this. This thing was like a bar stool seat on top of almost a sled-like thing that was a two wheels in front, one in the back to swing it around or something like that.
Yeah, it could do some really nice spin-on-a-dime moves.
It was very steerable.
Yeah.
And controllable. But it was somewhere between sitting height and standing height. I've got to think the reason they did that was to ease shooting of if she's going to have scenes with other people and they're all standing around, she's got to be at roughly the same elevation. The problem with that is they didn't raise her desks.
Yeah.
Either in the school she was apparently teaching something in or at the clock tower.
She spent a lot of time hunched over.
Yeah. And I think it would have made more sense if she just had either a standard wheelchair or what she typically has these days in the comics, I think, is the type that doesn't have like the armrests and it's more of the, I don't want to say the sports wheelchair, but something of that sort. I get why they went with what they did.
But basically her knees were at the height of her keyboard.
Yes. She couldn't pull into the desk because it wasn't raised.
Yeah.
But this was, I don't want to say before the era of standing desks, but it kind of feels like it was. Either way, you are doing a custom clock tower place for her setup. It's easy enough to lift the stuff. I also didn't understand why that area of the clock tower where her computer stuff was on a raised platform from the rest, which necessitated ramps at particular places.
Yeah.
So there were a few things that were a little odd there. But I appreciated the clock tower, which was pretty much pulled straight from the comics. I appreciated having Huntress and kind of, sort of, but not quite, Black Canary. Those were some of the mainstays of the comic version of the Birds of Prey.
I thought they chose the ages to put the characters at, both interestingly and well. In terms of, we had a 17-year-old Dinah, 23-year-old Huntress, and give or take 30 to 35-year-old Oracle.
Yeah.
So we had old enough to be mentor and guardian figure to the other two. We had the middle one who was at a good age to be older sister to the other one, raised by the first.
Well, you had one that was in the adult role, one was in that early young adult role, and one that was still in that late kid teenage stage.
And two of them were very clearly finding themselves. I wish they had been clearer about how soon after the Killing Joke this was. Oracle seemed pretty confident in her role.
7 years. I took it as...
Good point. You're
right.
The
Killing Joke happened the same time that Selina Kyle, formerly Catwoman, had been killed. She'd given up being Catwoman when Helena was born. But the instigating incident was 7 years ago when Selina was killed by the Joker.
Yep.
Setting the events in motion.
Yeah. Because, I mean, Oracle was pretty settled in and confident in her role, but there were still aspects of the teaching and the dual life that she was figuring out.
Well, if it was so much she was figuring out or that it was getting more complicated because she was forming attachments. I imagine for the previous couple of years, she had been a teacher there and was just very standoffish, didn't really get to know anybody all that well. But who's to say?
Yeah.
I think if this show had been later by a couple of years, it would have done better. Because the only superhero show on at the time was Smallville.
And this seemed to have the same people behind it.
Same people behind it, but a very different take.
Yes.
Because it was the no flights, no tights in Smallville, where it's standard, high school hijinks, and one guy happens to be Kryptonian.
Mm-hmm.
And another happens to be Lex Luthor, but aside from that. Whereas here, we have the Batgirl costume seen a number of times.
Mm-hmm.
We have Huntress kind of sort of in a costume.
Yeah.
It's kind of the black leather with a jacket kind of look that Dinah adopts a similar look later. So we're not hardcore into the costume realm, but we get enough, particularly with the setup with Batman. We see the Joker, we see Catwoman's costume, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Lady Shiva, when she shows up, she's in costume.
Mm-hmm.
And we get Clayface at one point, or a version, because there have been 1,000, it seems like, in the comics. So we get enough things that this is very much a comic bookish style show, more akin to the 80s Flash than the concurrent Smallville.
Mm.
And I think it was too comic book-ish for the audience at the time.
It was also much darker than any of the Smallville episodes I watched. And I didn't watch many, admittedly.
I watched the whole run, and very much this was a darker thing, but
I mean, that fits with Gotham, don't get me wrong.
Exactly what I was going to say. When you think of Metropolis, you think of the bright, sunshiny day. Gotham is always at night,
yeah.
Even in broad daylight. You know, it's a darker place.
Yeah.
So, I get the differences, but I think from a modern vantage point, it might be hard for some people to remember that this was not only before, like, the Arrowverse and the Marvel movies, but we hit a point during the peak of all of that where there was a new superhero show on every night on average.
Yeah.
Between Arrow, Flash, Supergirl, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Legends of Tomorrow, Black Lightning, trying to think which other shows, Lucifer, you could argue, is part of this. I mean, there were so many of these things coming out that we hit kind of that peak geek at some point, and this was a decade prior.
Well, and this was using the terms like metahuman, and awkwardly, unfortunately.
I didn't find it awkward, but I'm used to it, so.
Awkwardly in terms of the I'm half human, half metahuman.
Okay, that one I did mention when we got into it. I take issue with Huntress being referred to by Alfred in the opening explanation dialogue and in the show itself as half metahuman. If humans have no powers and metahumans have powers and she has powers, she's metahuman.
Yeah.
Yes. Her father was a normal, Batman. I can't say Batman is normal, but in this world, it seemed to be the Catwoman from the Burton era movies, and she was kind of sort of metahuman, but typically in the comics, she's not, but they were playing it as she's got feline-ish powers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, her eyes do the little cat eye thing, and she can jump up 20 stories or whatever. She's practically bionic.
She always lands on her feet.
Always lands on her feet. And I loved some of the scenes they did where Reese would turn around and bam, she's there or whatever. But then later, once he knows she's got powers and such, we see her kind of gliding down from a rooftop.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those shots were beautifully done.
Yeah.
Now, the show did use computer effects. There was the one shot we get where we see her having jumped off the roof, going down, landing on a roof, and there's three buildings adjacent to each other. Run from one, do kind of the somersault flip to the next, run, somersault flip, run through the next, jump off the other building. We saw that shot 1,000 times, it felt like, in 13 episodes. But then they also had a computer model of this Gotham, or let me rephrase it. They had a computer model of a city. It happened to have the clock tower in it. And we would go kind of pull out and zoom, fly around to get to the next location, sometimes ambiguously. But the reason I refer to it as a city versus this city is it never really felt like there were any recognizable landmarks other than the clock tower.
Yeah. I mean, the school, when we got right up on top of it, had the name.
Well, same with Gotham PD and a few things like that, or New Gotham PD. But I guess for me, it's easier to do a recognizable cityscape in Metropolis. You've got the Daily Planet. You've got the LexCorp building. Those two right there. It gives you two vantage points. You can kind of triangulate where you are based on that. There didn't seem to be a Wayne Foundation building, a Wayne Tower, any of that stuff anywhere to be found in town.
Well, the clock tower didn't make sense to me. I mean, I love the concept.
I love the concept, but you're right. When you've got a skyscraper. It had to be, I felt, 20 stories or higher.
That's where I was going to go.
At the top, it insets at least 10 feet in every direction, and then there's a clock tower as part of that, with the building still being 40, 50 feet at least square inside of it, probably more. But because it's set back the 10 feet and stuff at the top of at least a 20-story building, other than from other skyscrapers at the upper floors, there's no vantage point in which you would ever see the clock tower, or the clock on the tower.
Yeah.
It's not like Big Ben, where it's out in the middle, I don't want to say of anywhere, but the edge of the Thames River, that you can see it from across the way. You can read the clock.
Yes.
So that was a little perplexing. However, I think that can be said of the comic version as well.
Okay.
But I don't think we spent as much time flying through the city as we did between shots there to really notice that.
I am curious, not that we could get answers to these questions, but I wish I understood more about the production of the show and what they went through when it was airing.
Yes.
Things like Stephen McHattie as Al Hawk in the explosion.
We get a nice reveal at that end of that episode when the character has been through some trauma. He's in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we pick up with that a few episodes later, he has been replaced with Mitch Pileggi.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them are good actors.
Yep.
They look nothing alike. Mm-hmm. That was part of the story.
Yep.
Of he was damaged enough and, okay, he got a new face out of this.
But he also got a little bit of a new personality. I mean, he lost his whole zen thing.
Completely lost his zen. Completely different personality, different voice. I didn't check the eye colors, but yeah. That had to be either McHattie was unavailable, didn't work out, they didn't want him back, he didn't want to come back. I don't know, something. And it may have just been, again, scheduling.
Mm-hmm.
And Pileggi did a decent job with it. It just felt there was behind-the-scenes stuff that had to...
He wasn't given great material for the first half of the episode. The second half of the episode, they started giving him better material.
He got better material, but I also don't know that he had the opportunity to watch McHattie's version of the character.
Yeah.
And he certainly wasn't written as the same character, although he clearly was.
Mm-hmm.
So I assume different writers for the two episodes. But we've seen other shows where a character either gets recast or they do a younger version that requires a different actor.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them, it's clear that they've watched the main actor's portrayal. They've studied the mannerisms. They've adopted a few of the mannerisms.
Yeah.
I think the younger versions of Alex and Kara from Supergirl, there was one episode that focused on them, and it's like, yeah, that's believably the same characters.
Yes. Yes.
We saw the same thing in The Way Home.
Mm-hmm.
When we had Delilah and Colton as kids.
Yep.
And that played well. I would say another good example of this, and it's one that I don't think many people would necessarily think of, is Daniel Jackson in Stargate SG-1, where Michael Shanks started with the mannerisms that James Spader had from the movie,
mm-hmm.
but slowly shifted to where it was his own character after about a season or two.
Yeah.
But when you start, it's like, yeah, that's the same guy.
Yeah.
And that takes some skill.
That was well done in that show. Yeah.
Both on the acting, the writing, the directing, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And here, again, it's got the same name. It's clearly Jesse's father in both cases, but it was, I don't say a night and day difference. It was a jarring difference in the attitude of the character.
Yeah.
And there was so little to go on that it's not like it would have taken that long to watch the episode, or at least the dailies from it.
I don't remember how far apart the episodes were to know if they would have had the episode through editing and able to be watched, but at least give him the script.
We'll give the writer the script.
Yeah, yeah.
I can see where they didn't have the finished episode, potentially.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt that was a dropped ball.
Yeah. I felt the first half of the season had, I'm going to call it a different mindset than the second half. And by that I mean, we ended out on the balcony looking over the city.
Yeah, yeah.
Every episode.
And we both referred to that as kind of the Boston Legal ending.
Mm-hmm.
Where you would end with the two characters out on the balcony having a drink. Here, they weren't having the drink, but they were outside the face of the clock tower, overlooking the city, and let's wrap up for the day.
It was no matter what we've been through, no matter what struggles we've had even between us, we come back together as a unit.
Yes, come back together as a unit, ground ourselves at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
lick our wounds and move on.
Yeah. And that fell by the wayside.
Yeah.
It also felt like the first half of the season, they knew Harley Quinn was the big bad. They were setting it up. They were on a roll.
Not the characters.
True. Sorry. Yes. True. The writers. But then somewhere around that midway point, it was almost like they got a memo saying, you're going too heavy on this season arc. We need some standalone episodes. We need to tone down the citywide organized crime conspiracy.
Yeah, there was a point where she seemed to be behind everything, and then suddenly, where the hell did she go?
Yeah.
I had some problems with that, and I think from what we're seeing on IMDb, that the cord was cut around episode 11. They had the 13 episode commitment, so they wrote the last two knowing it had to wrap everything up, and they brought the character back, tied it all in, and mm-hmm. went. So I don't think that was necessarily their original game plan, but it worked.
Mm-hmm. It did.
And I appreciated that, but there did seem to be a couple of writers that either didn't get certain memos, weren't on board with certain things, or that they were just retooling the show as they were figuring it out. Because mm-hmm. if you look at the first season of Smallville, early on, it was very much Freak of the Week.
Oh, yes.
And there were aspects of that here.
Yeah.
And you need to get a certain amount of shows under your belt to start to realize what's working, what's not. The whole bit where Helena was set up as a bartender initially, and then we don't see the bar for a decent chunk of the show mm-hmm. until finally it's kind of back in the tail end.
Yeah.
And at one point it was unclear. It's like, is she living at the clock tower? Because it was kind of implied. But then it's like, no, she lives over at the bar, but she doesn't own the bar. She just works there. But it was weird.
Yeah.
So there were a few things that it's not that they didn't have it figured out. It's that I felt they didn't bother to figure it out. It's us. She works at a bar. What more do we need to know?
Yeah. But the thought that they were putting in came from what I refer to as this being from a different era of television. And that was most episodes had, if not a moral, a lesson or a takeaway.
Or at least a theme. This yeah. is about family. This is about redemption. This is about who do you want to be?
Yeah. And they did a lot, both on the relationships between parent and child.
Yeah.
Who do you want to be? What determines who you are? Both the nature-nurture aspect, the how you respond to things.
Well, and the nature of grief.
Yes.
Touched on quite a bit through this. I thought it was a good show. It was just out there at a time where the audience wasn't ready for it.
Yeah. I mean, in some respects, I think it had, in terms of the, it didn't go, I feel, towards social commentary so much as, like you said, the themes or the lessons. So there was that meat on the bone that you came out of it. And honestly, one of the lessons I loved the most, or one of the episodes, sorry, I loved the most, I think it was called Three Birds and a Baby.
Oh, when they had the kid that aged rapidly.
Yeah.
There were some interesting things on that. And I appreciated they took a little time of, okay, this was literally a baby when you brought him to the clock tower. He takes a nap. Suddenly he's about 4 and can speak.
Mm-hmm.
How did he learn? And not only did they raise the question, but we learned that part of his development is there's a cybernetic thing in him that feeds him that information so he can know how to do walking, talking, and basic functions of life that he simply would not have had time to learn in his 4-day existence.
Yeah.
So I thought it was a level of thinking it through that many shows wouldn't even bother with.
Yeah.
So I felt they had enough respect for the audience
mm-hmm.
that many shows didn't.
And they had some nice heartfelt moments.
Yeah. I do have to say, though, that watching Shamar then versus now, watching Rachel Skarsten then versus now,
mm-hmm.
there are certain things that certain actors do, that's how they are.
Yeah, certain bits of body language acting business.
How they deliver a line, mm-hmm. the expression they use, a few things like that, and not in a bad way.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there are certain lines that it would not surprise me if Dinah used here and Alice used in Gotham and Batwoman
yeah.
many years later. So I thought that was kind of interesting. What was funny, particularly with Rachel Skarsten, is even though she was on Batwoman at the time of Crisis, Because I'm pretty sure the show had already started at that point. Or did they introduce Batwoman and then do the show? Either way, I thought they had at least established Alice at that point. I could be wrong. But she wasn't used in Crisis, where they were using everybody else under the sun. But they brought in Ashley Scott as Helena for, you know, a scene or two.
Yeah.
And it's like, man, we could have had, it would have been, I think, a lot of fun to have had this Dinah Lance with at least the Sarah Lance.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of how are they similar, different? Having that Black Canary meet that White Canary could have been fun.
Yeah.
That's the kind of stuff, though, that in live action shows, you're at the mercy of the budget, the filming constraints. Who do you have when, even if you've got somebody on one of the shows, that doesn't necessarily mean you can fit in everything you want to do.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's a comic event, yeah, you just spin up another one shot and you do it there or in a backup or something.
Mm-hmm.
This was a surprisingly realized world for 13 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed it. I thought it was good. There were a few things that I think they would have gone back to if they'd had more time.
I agree.
I mean, they never once even brought up the question of who was Dinah's father.
No, never touched on that. And they never touched on Detective Reese realizing or discovering he had something unexpected in common with Helena Kyle. Both of them have a criminal for a parent.
Yeah.
And yet they're on the side of the law and good.
I think the way that would have played out is at some point, Reese's mother would have been a story element.
Mm.
Whether she shows up or not, this is what happened with his mother, because she's still alive in the show. We just never see her. And that would cause him to ask, well, what was your mother like? And I think there could be some fun stuff.
Yeah.
What's interesting, though, is even though this is a generation past Batman, I mean, Batgirl had been active 7 years ago, so it's not like a full generation past or whatever, but it'd been a generation for Catwoman, because she stopped when Helena was born. But Jesse Reese, the detective, had these theories that there's more happening than people realize and whatnot, and was mocked at the police station for it and was kind of an outcast. But it's like, had everybody forgotten the whole era of Batman, the Joker, Catwoman, Clayface? I mean, when Reese is told about Clayface, he's like, you're kidding, right? Do they have no archives in this place?
Or do they just not look and believe? I mean, there are things from 20, 30 years ago that we find unbelievable.
That's true. That's true. And I can easily imagine in a Gotham City with a notoriously corrupt police force, there may not really be any archives.
Mm, yeah.
Literally. It all just gets chucked. Maybe even before the case is over.
Yeah.
I really wish this had gotten more time.
Me too. I enjoyed it when it first aired. I enjoyed it now. I wanted to watch it after we watched the Birds of Prey and the
Harley, the
Fantabulous Emancipation, of Harley Quinn.
The title it keeps going for about a
novel. I enjoyed this more than the movie.
Oh, this was much better than the movie. And it's funny because Harley, we see as much of Harley here, if not more, than in the movie, with 13 episodes versus a movie. But this really did focus on the Birds of Prey.
Mm-hmm.
And treated Harley as the villain, as she is.
Mm-hmm. But it also showed Harley, I don't want to say becoming the villain, because that's not quite fair, but it showed the complexity. Well, having the psychology practice as a hobby.
Yeah.
Because the patients are there for her amusement and fun.
And they gave us the backstory of her relationship with the Joker and all that. It seemed like nobody really seemed to know that, though, or who Harley Quinn was.
Yeah.
So if they'd gotten more time, I'm curious, would we have gotten maybe an episode, a season, kind of like how when they did some of the flashback as to what happened when Catwoman was killed and all that stuff, that would sort of have started fleshing out the Gotham in the day?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe at least the era of the Batman, if nothing else. You know, what happened to Commissioner Gordon? And how did all of this get kind of swept under the rug and forgotten about?
Mm-hmm.
And there are many ways they, I think, could have conceivably done that. But this was still an era where superhero shows were few and far between. Smallville was doing gangbusters. This, I don't think, did.
It was also an era when you didn't have a lot of serious or action shows with three female leads.
Yes. Well, any shows with three female leads, for the most part.
you know, you go back to the 80s, you had Kate and Allie.
Fair enough.
You had Cagney and Lacey.
But even those, I think, were more the exception than the rule.
Yep.
And doing a female-led show, a female-led action show, a comic book show with very visible trappings of comic books.
Mm-hmm.
That's a hard sell at that point.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's an easy sell today. It's easier now than it was then.
Yeah. But I think especially keeping in mind the 20 years ago aspect. So
nearly 25. Yeah.
Forgiving them for some of the shots where we're zooming around and I'm like, oh, this looks like
video game level.
Yeah.
Graphics. No argument there.
Yeah. So forgiving them, if you will, for the 20 years that have passed, the show holds up. It holds up better than I expected.
It held up well for me. There were a few things I didn't like. I really disliked the effect they used for Black Canary's sonic cry.
That confused me.
They were trying to show that she's shouting, so having it almost be the sonic circle, kind of like Aquaman's effect in Super Friends.
But it was almost like she had to suck something in
to charge it. Yeah, she was sucking the sound out to throw it back. It was weird. You see a similar thing in, I forget if it was Smallville or some of the others, where Superman's about to fly, and like there's a gravity effect before it propels him up.
Mm.
It seemed to be the same idea. We need to show the buildup.
Yeah, yeah.
I hated it now. I hated it back then. Lori Loughlin, I think, did good with the material she was given. I didn't care for that take on Black Canary.
The aspect I didn't care for was the, I put my kid with someone else to be safe and protected, and then just believed all was good for 10 years or more.
Yeah, there was a little bit of a where the hell had she been? And she came to New Gotham not realizing her daughter was there. There was more to the story than was told. Should have been.
If she had had a line of, you know, they were sending me a letter every month telling me how they were using the money I was sending to help support you and how well you were doing in school and all this. And Dinah simply rebutted with, Mom, you bought their lies instead of coming to check?
You were friends with Oracle and you didn't have her keep tabs?
Yeah, yeah. You know, that would have given it more credibility to me.
Yeah, there were some holes in that story.
Mm-hmm.
But seeing her there, again, Stephen McCaddy, Mitch Pileggi, we saw the one from Joe Flanagan from Stargate Atlantis, among other shows.
Mm-hmm. And he did really well with what he was given.
Oh, he did great with that role. He did a terrific job. I think he was one of the best guest stars they had. They had some good ones.
Yeah.
So they got some quality guest cast. Regular cast, I thought, did a terrific job. So, it's 13 episodes. There's, I think, an unaired version of the pilot. The only real difference is they went with a different actress for Harley Quinn.
Mm-hmm.
Mia Sara did a better job.
Yeah, she did.
I don't
did.
Think it's worth seeing the unaired pilot. It's minor tweaks, mainly recasting for that. 13 episodes is not a big time commitment. These things wind up being, I don't know, 43, 44 minutes, all said and done.
Mm-hmm.
We got through it in, what, 3 evenings?
Yeah, that sounds right.
At a leisurely pace, I think.
Yeah, and really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's fun. It's worth watching. If you liked the Arrowverse-type shows, this is about that level of superheroics. And we get the action and stuff like that. I guess it's some of those shows have more of the window dressing, the costumes and stuff like this. This leaned heavily into it without going full hog into it.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I thought it was a lot of fun, much better than the Birds of Prey Harley Quinn movie. That wasn't a high bar to surpass, though. Anything else?
I think that does it.
Cool. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you liked this episode, please spread the word about the Comic Book Page podcast by telling your friends and posting a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And please, join our Slack community and let us know what you thought of this episode. I do this podcast because I enjoy talking about comics. So let's talk about comics. The show notes, forum, and instructions for how to join our Slack channel can be found at www.comicbookpage.com. The opinions of the co-hosts and guests are their own. The Comic Book Page podcast is copyright John Mayall. And thanks again for listening.